Was there a network with Korean Americans in other other cities?
Yes, there was no set network, but you knew in our days. I mean, present day is impossible because of the numbers. But in the early days, if there was a family in Chicago, we knew who they were, and they were organized. You know, like the Hungsadan. If they were in New York. It was either through knowing who they were or through the church, and they also had a Korean National Association group. The Korean National Association group, you know, expanded nationwide, or even to Hawaii. Oh, I shouldn't even say that, even to Cuba, Mexico.
Did your father start this group?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When was that?
1906.
And that was really the first organization?
Organized. I mean, he had started a couple of other things in the early years, but this was the first really strong organization that took care of the immigrants who came to the United States and needed aid. So, and there again, I think it was practicing your Korean heritage and try to assimilate into the American way of life.
So were there visitors coming from other cities all the time, or was there a lot of back and forth with people in the other cities?
Yes, between San Francisco and ourselves, I mean, there was all constant movement. Danuba, Reedley, there was constant movement. I mean, if you lived in Los Angeles, you knew almost everybody in the United States. You knew who they were.
It's really incredible.
But it was so few in number.
Yeah.
It's so few in number, and your mission was the same. I mean, it was for the independence of Korea. I think that makes a great deal of difference of how a community reacts.
Yeah. What relationship did Korean Americans have with other Asian Americans in Los Angeles?
Well, in Los Angeles, I think we were very friendly with the Chinese group, and that was because it was allowable. With the Japanese group, it was not really the thing to do to have any participation with them, except maybe an odd friendship, you know, and that was okay. I mean, that was no problem. But in our house, though, you didn't have any Japanese people come as friends. You know, I mean, it was sort of a silent protection. Like, if you didn't do that, then you weren't protecting yourself against the Japanese regime. We used to, and there's a friend that I think I told you this before, that I went to school with, and she was actually very responsible for my going away to college. It was, she and I had gone to junior college together, and when she was ready to go to San Diego State, she said, "Well, why don't you come?" And, you know, I don't have any money. I can't leave home. I mean, it's just one of those things. And she says, "Well," she says, "I think I can help you out." Her sister was a social worker. And so we borrowed $50 from her. And I was able to go down and to San Diego State and get a job, etc. But Sylvia and I still see each other all the time. But she used to come to the house, and there was no problem, you know, because she was American. But we taught her to, whenever she bought anything, you know, to look under to see if it made in Japan, and she couldn't buy it, we wouldn't let her. But that was our protection. So still today, she looks under to see if it was made in Japan. But she was a good friend. I mean, she, when my daughter went to Harvard, I was short $2,000 to get her off properly. So she lent me $2,000, and she said, just, you know, pay me back whenever. So when my daughter was ready to pay her back, you know, she gave her the $2,000, and she said, "No, just keep it and pass it on to somebody else. Do the same thing for somebody else." So. Then I have this other friend that I think I told you this story before about the grocer who helped us survive, and it was his daughter, and she was in the fifth grade. But every time she sees us, she says, "Oh, I remember your brother when he came home from the hospital. He was this small on the bed, you know." And she just recalls that, and she still calls me.
It's a long ties.
Yeah, long relationship, yeah.
What about relationship with Filipinos in the early days?
There wasn't any.
Uh-huh.
There wasn't any. In fact, they were, in the early days, if they worked, I've forgotten, you know, what field they were in, mostly houseboys, I guess. But they were in the Navy. Most of the Filipinos in the early days were in the Navy. And there was no reason to be sociable with them.
Right.
They didn't have families. They didn't have a community. Japanese and the Chinese had communities.
How did the relationships change over time
with
other Asian Americans?
Well, I think that was just sort of a normal development. I don't think there was any great difference in how we reacted to other Asians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were friendly with the Chinese. And the Chinese and the Japanese communities also changed. As we changed, they changed, you know, so.
You had touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to know what ties were maintained with Korea and whether there was correspondence with your extended family there.
Not during the regime under the Japanese. Well, I shouldn't say that because my father was in prison in 1932 and died in prison in 1938. But he did write to my mother. He couldn't write to her before, you know, because he was so tied up with the independence movement. But when he was in prison, he was allowed to write one letter a month. And so he took that opportunity to write to her. And so we have a file of his letter. Well, the originals are in Korea at the Independence Hall. And it's very sad. I mean, he promises her that, or he hopes that they would get together and be a family, and that he thanks her for taking care of the family, and he's concerned about the girls' marriages, and you know, and in one letter he writes to me, he says, "And don't let Ralph ruin the plants." And I thought to myself, we laugh about it, the nerve of him to think that his son that he has not seen is going to ruin his plants. God, I tell you, it was so... But that was the only communication that we had with Korea.
What about your grandparents? Were they living?
No. No, I had no grandparents. Well, another problem was that the country got divided. And so North Korea, we have cousins in North Korea, and they write to us. But it's difficult to keep up a normal relationship, I should say. They write to me and tell me that I should write to Kim Il-sung and thank him for saving my father's life and things like that, you know. But they're very... devoted to Kim Il-sung. And so, you know, I would think their minds are a little bit warped.
What do you mean for saving your father's life?
Well, the story is that my father was arrested in Kilim, Manchuria in 1928 or something like that. And he was arrested by the Chinese, and Kim Il-sung was a group of young students who protested, and so they weren't turned over to the Japanese And they claimed that they saved my father's life. That's a story that Kim Il-sung tells. I think it was 1928. I may be wrong.
I see. Have you been to Korea?
Yes, several times.
When was the first time?
The first time that we went was in 1973 when they opened an 8-acre memorial park for my father. And he had a 25-foot bronze statue. And it's really a nice little park. And what has happened now is that it's only the green area that's left in the city, you know, because there's so much building around it. And so if you go there on Sundays, you have nothing but brides and grooms running around all over the place taking pictures, you know. And I think, how nice. My father would like that. And then we took my mother's body at that same time and buried them together because they never could live together during their living days. But, you know, in death, they're together. And so we like that. And
so what was your experience? What were your impressions of going?
Well, it was kind of exciting to be on Korean soil for the first time, you know. And of course, I can't give you a general feeling on anything because I didn't get to go as a normal person, you know. I mean, you were taken care of, you know, so you only your experience was very limited to the celebration mode. And so I would say that, you know, we never really got a picture of Korea.
Because you were the daughter of Dosan.
Well, and I went for my brother, my big brother, at that time.
With Philip?
Philip, yeah. And he was, you know, the chief of everything. I mean, he could handle the world. I mean, it was no. So that was real easy, and that was kind of great. And I mean, and then the next time, I forgot what the next time. Probably what the next time was for handing our stuff over to the Independence Hall. You know, it was, my mother had done this great deed of saving papers from 1902 to 1938 till the last breath of my father. And she carried these things all over with her, whether she went to Danube to pick grapes or whether she went Riverside to pick oranges. I mean, she took these with her.
And was it really boxes of papers?
Boxes of papers. And it ended up with, their accounting, 3,125 pieces of items that she carted around with her. I mean, this woman was something else. But, you know, when she married him, she knew she had married somebody. And that was in 1902, before Korea ever had any problems. Well, they had problems, but not being overtaken by the Japanese. Yeah. But she came with him to study Western democracy.
Let's see. What else I have to ask you? Oh, well, when did Koreatown and in Los Angeles become developed?
I'm not really sure. What, 1960? About 1960, I guess. And that's when the big wave of Koreans came in. I can't remember when it was developed. One thing I have to say about Koreatown, though, is like, I recall what my daughter said as we were driving through. She says, the nerve of those people, they don't even have any subtitles. I feel the same way today. I mean, I think that there's a plan now to do that. But that might be wishful thinking, I don't know. But I think there is a plan, yeah. But I think there should be more interaction. And for an American to be able to, a white American or a non-Korean, to go down there and be able to shop. But you can't do that, you know, if you don't speak Korean.
Really?
Well, yeah. Where are you going to go? I mean, read the signs. I mean, there's no signs to read.
What are some of the differences, or what is the relationship between the older generations of Korean Americans and the newer immigrants in Koreatown?
Well, you mean the pioneer Koreans?
Yeah.
Well, it never developed into any kind of a cohesive arrangement. The new Koreans that came in went on their own way, and the pioneer Korean elements stayed their own way. And by this time, the pioneer Koreans had gone into different areas and had split up as families, and there was no one community. So we were no longer a community, whereas the Koreans that came were developing their own community. And unfortunately, they were not tolerant of the American-born Koreans, mostly because we didn't speak their language. And so there were some bad feelings. But, you know, we're such a minority of people that it really makes no difference. The only thing is that I think the Korean community ought to learn to be a little more tolerant of not only other ethnic groups, but of their own ethnic group that they don't understand.
Why do you think that is?
This
non-tolerance.
I would just think it was lack of direction, lack of education. I mean, they all piled into one place to make a living, and as long as they could make a dollar, I mean, it was okay with them. And many of them were successful. And now they just, you know, depend on each other.
Right. Well, is there, kind of a respect, though, for some of the pioneer families? Or, well, like, well, let's take your father, for example.
Well, of course, my father is a different category altogether. I mean, you know, he can't be put into the same.
Right.
No, but we are trying to develop this Korean American National Museum. And the prime motive for that is to recognize the pioneer Koreans who gave so much of their life, actually, the energy, I mean, the money, whatever they could. I mean, they gave to the independence movement. And, you know, I tell this big story about if it wasn't for those overseas Koreans, they could have never accomplished the independence of Korea. And therefore, they do need to recognize that effort. And I think this Korean National American Museum will be one of the vehicles to do that. And we're in this group, we're blending together. It's really kind of nice, the old Koreans, the pioneer Korean children, and the new Koreans in the two groups are kind of blending very nicely. So, but the one problem with the Korean community is that they know little about Korean history. They know little about how they were subjugated by the Japanese and how terrible it was. I mean, they just have no concept. I mean, if you went down the street and asked a 10-year-old or 12-year-old, I don't know whether they would even know that the Japanese were in Korea. I don't know. I may be telling a big lie, but but I think that's one of our problems.
Yes. Susan, what have been the most important events in your life?
The most important event in my life, I think, was when I joined the Navy. It was an opportunity to go to war against the Japanese, which had suppressed the country, and etc. And it gave me a great opportunity. I was very privileged because they gave me every consideration a human being could have. I mean, they recognized me as the first Korean wave. They gave me every consideration, I would say, in the Navy that any person could expect. And there was no such thing as what you would call racial prejudice in my experience within the Navy. I was always treated with great respect. I was given every opportunity to be promoted. I was never held back. I was never chided for being Oriental. I was given all kinds of news accounts of a Korean wave fighting the Japanese. And I had nothing but great experience.
So what would you say your greatest successes then were?
I would think that my, you mean now?
Yeah, and throughout your life.
Yeah, throughout my life?
Yeah.
Well, I think the greatest success that I have in my life is working for the United States government. I ended my career in Washington as the person that worked for the National Security Agency. And the fact that I was trusted enough to work for that kind of an organization, I felt that was a great attribute. And it said something for a person being Korean. Also, I was the first Oriental to be accepted into naval intelligence. And so I think those are my most rewarding experiences. But of course, my greatest joy are my two children. My daughter is a very successful entertainment lawyer, and my son is now trying to do a documentary on his grandfather, and he's has studied Korean history very deeply. And if there's any question about the Korean history, I can always ask him, come up with an answer. He can give me dates and names. I couldn't answer some of your dates and names because I don't have that kind of a mind. But he's very brilliant in that field. And I'm very proud because the fact that it could have, the line of information could have stopped with me, but it's not, it's going on with him. So I hope that he can preach to the world the Korean-American history.
Yes.
But we just have to learn to blend. And you know, I don't know how you do that, but that's what we have to do, is to learn to blend. Not even join, but blend, you know?
What do you mean, really?
Well, just kind of nonchalantly become part of the community. I mean, without the big to-do about being, having all these organizations, you know, the blacks and the
Korean. Oh, you mean to mix? To mix?
Yeah. Just, I mean, the idea is just to become part of the surroundings.
Uh-huh.
Without not a lot of, you know. There are a lot of Korean families that live in different areas. They don't speak to their neighbors. This friend that I was telling you about, my very good friend of the college days, she has a Korean neighbor. They never have, maybe they've said hello twice, and they've lived there about 5 years.
So what would you say your greatest disappointments have been?
That's such a Pollyanna, I don't have a disappointment. I can't say that I had any disappointments. I mean, I think I achieved everything I set out to do. And, well, I'm kind of an accepting person, you know, and so a lot of big deals aren't big deals to me, and so maybe that's why I feel that way. But I really have no great disappointment, so to speak. No tragedy in my life.
And who have been your role models?
I guess my mother is my role model. I mean, her, she was such a brave woman. I mean, she never complained about her plight. And I think that's one reason my young brother would say, too, that we all came out halfway decent citizens, is because there was never a aura of being misused. I mean, she never felt that she was handicapped by her husband being away. She raised the kids on her own. She taught us whatever else we had to learn. I mean, she guided us, and I would think that she becomes my role model. The other role model, of course, I had would be Miss Esther Bartlett, who is the executive secretary up at the International Institute. So, oh, I do have one more role model. He was a professor at San Diego State. And in those days, there was a outfit called NYA, I think it was National Youth something or other, and you got jobs through the school, you know, as one of these welfare program type things. And so I joined that, and they sent me to his office to become his assistant or whatever. And this is a strange story, because when we lived on 37th Street, he was going to USC earning his doctorate, and he used to walk past that house every day, you know, because he had to go from the school to wherever he was living or something. And he was about 6'5" tall, and he was very composed, you know. Not very handsome, but very composed. I used to yank my mother and say, "See that man? That's the kind of man I'm going to marry," you know, because I love tall men. So that was it. Then I go down to San Diego State, and I apply for a job, and they send me into this office, and guess who's sitting there? This man. But that man provided me with a life that was, at college, that was just indescribable. He was an advisor to a fraternity group, and he got me into being Miss Fraternity Group, whatever the name was. I mean, he offered me so many of the social niceties that you can't achieve in a Korean community by yourself, you know. Or even if you went to college by yourself, you wouldn't have them. But he just propelled me into all of these activities, and he insisted I take oral interpretation and speech so that I could, you know, I was kind of inward in those days. I was not very outgoing. And then I assisted him in working with a patient that had what they call aphasia in those days, and he was in the Navy, and that man had been struck by sunlight or something, and he couldn't speak anymore. We went to the San Diego Naval Hospital every day. I went with him because he was a speech therapist. Every day, I recorded all the activities for him, and he recovered his speech and became normal, which was fine. So they took him back into the Navy. And do you know that when I was in Atlantic City on the station as a gunnery officer, who walks in but this young man? I mean, it just... But in the meantime, I have all this, you know, experience and learning and being, you know, learning to be outgoing, etc., and having the confidence, you know, finally having confidence enough to go join the Navy. And without his help, from before, I would have been a bungle, you know. But, you know, when they started to come to me for interviews and make radio presentations or be a gunnery officer, the lead gunnery officer, you know, you had to have some way to, you know, have some speech that would be effective. And I think to myself, you know, that man really...
How would you say that you're viewed in the Korean-American community?
Well, I think it's clouded, you know, because I don't think they look at me as me. They look at me as Dosan Ancheon's daughter, so, you know, I don't know.
Would that be the similar case for your siblings? Do they have a similar...
Oh, yes, I think so. I think so, yeah. Uh-huh. So I think that aura of father is so overcoming that. you have no personality when you.
Oh, so how do people respond to you then because of that?
Great. I mean, I have all the respect that I need. I mean, they also. I had an interview with some lady who was writing for a local newspaper. She, at the end of the interview, she was so overwhelmed with I don't know what, you know, because she had never heard anyone speak so openly about how Korean, you should keep your Korean heritage. And she's just recently from Korea, a year. She was just. And then I had an interview with Radio Korea yesterday, and this young man was, he says, I've had lots of interviews, but he said, this one is really, really good. And I said, well, thank you.
Well, I'm so glad that you fit me into your interview schedule.
But you're the beginner. I mean, you began it all. You're the...
And now I wanted to... just bring it up to the present, to sort of current events in L.A., and ask what your experience over last year's riots was and what your feelings about that were.
Well, I don't have too much to do with any riot problem. I was concerned, but, you know, fortunately there were plenty of other people involved. And being of the older generation, I didn't think that there was much that I could do to contribute, because you have all these very eloquent second generation, third generation, I guess, and they're all taking part. And so I really felt there was no necessity for it to me to be a, you know, I'm so used to being a spokesperson for everything, but I didn't think it was necessary for me to be involved in that, with plenty of people taking care of that. I think that I don't know, it seemed like it was such a mismatch, hodgepodge of events, and I was kind of glad not to be trying to evolve anything out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there were plenty of people.
Right.
You know, so I felt that they were not derelict.
What are your feelings about what happened?
Well, you know, I think it's not a Korean problem. It's actually an Afro-American problem. I mean, the Koreans just happened to be there, you know. And some of them are going right back into the area. So, you know, I think that's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are a lot of... I think... the essential problem is in the black community. And the Koreans just happened to be there. I mean, I don't think it was a problem between the blacks and the Koreans. They like to make it that way. I mean, you read the press and you have them all espousing all the problems. But I think that if you take it right down and analyze it, the problems are minimal. It's just that they got burned out because they had the stores. They were the ones that were willing to stay 12, 15 hours in a store and keep it going. The black community, I think, has a huge problem, you know, of developing their own self-worth, especially in that area. And they have so many gangs, you know, so many things that are not... okay, you know. I don't know. Maybe nobody else believes that, but I believe that the Koreans were just victims, not participants.
And now, what do you think some of the greatest changes that you've seen in your lifetime here in Los Angeles?
Oh, the overwhelming influx of immigrants. That, I think, is a great sociological change, and whether we can all melt into a happy community remains to be seen. But you know that. But I really think that's a real big problem. You got pockets of immigrants all over the place, you know. There would be no problem if they all wanted to blend in.
That's where you feel the solution.
Oh, yeah. The solution is to be good to your neighbor. Or to understand your neighbor. Be friends with your neighbor. Mm-hmm. Or know your neighbor, even. You know.
So what are your present plans? What do you do now?
Well, right now I'm trying to put my brother's memorabilia together so that we can pass it on somewhere. CSUN wants it, USC wants it, Korea wants it. And I think my job is to put it in some kind of order. And that's my present occupation.
Well, this is something you've been involved with for quite some time
Yes.
now, as the sort of family archivist.
Yeah, right. It's I don't mind doing it, though. I enjoy it. I'm not as, let's say, agile as I was before. I remember when I worked for the government, I had an asset that I didn't forget any item, and it was real, you know, wonderful. I don't have that asset anymore, so, you know, I have to depend on writing or note-taking or something.
Like the rest of us.
Oh, no! That was one great asset that I had when I worked for the government and in research. I wished I had that facility back.
What are your plans for the future?
I have no plans for the future. I just hope that I'll be healthy. And if anyone needs my help, if they ask me, I'll be there to help them. I'm very, how do I say, open to giving interviews and everything, because I do think I represent or can give a view on something that's going to be lost if I don't do it. And then because I am, if for the Korean aspect, because I am the daughter of An Chang-ho, I feel that I owe the community or whoever's interested in complying with whatever they would like to hear. I think that a lot of people, well, the other day someone said to me, he said, you know, we used to read about your father, and my father told me about your father, but we never dreamt that we would be able to converse with one of his children, you know. And I think because of that, I keep saying yes to all these interviews and everything.
Well, you're a piece of him. Mm-hmm. People see you as a piece of him. You are.
I say, the aura is behind. They don't even look at you as a person, you know. So, that's life.
Well, is there anything that you'd like to add to this interview that we haven't talked about?
Oh, I don't think so, except that I'm very, very happy that I was born in the United States. I am very happy that I lived an American life, that I've had the opportunities that were given me and the pleasures of just ordinary living. And although we grew up very poor, we all have been able to achieve our professions rather well. Consequently, I have no problems. I just think that the oncoming generations have to learn to blend their Americanism with their Korean heritage. And, you know, the Korean heritage, I think, is very important. I mean, because for one thing, your face is never going to change, you know. You're going to be different. And so if you can take pride in what makes you different, you know, you can go to school and they say, well, you can read some things about people being called Japanese or Chinese, etc. So what? I mean, when I was going to college, what did they say to me? What nationality are you? I said, guess. And they say, Japanese? No. Chinese? No. Eskimo? No. Samoan? No. Never heard of Korean. Didn't know what a Korean was. But now everybody knows what a Korean is. No, I'm very happy that I was born in the United States and that I'm American. And voting privileges? Ha ha. My mother is the one that used to push us out to vote.
Oh, really?
Really. You know, when you're young, it doesn't seem so important. Voting day comes, out you go to vote.
And she would vote too. She was a...
She was never a citizen.
Uh-huh.
So she never could vote, but she made sure that all of us did. So she was an unusual woman.
Has she received much attention as being...
No. I think the same like the rest of us, because she's the wife of this great mm-hmm. person, recognition for her is very hard to come by. I think that they had a little inkling of it when we sent the stuff to Korea that she had saved and gathered and saved. I think they realized. But in the early Korean days, you know, a woman was just nothing. You know, and that's the way this gender was brought up. And so you were always second class. And I think until they got educated. But I don't know. They may do something for my mother. I don't know. I hope they do it before I die.
Thank you very much, Susan.
Amy, it's a great pleasure to be able to be interviewed by you.